Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer and artist, and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field. If you've been listening to this podcast or are new to it, I thank you very much. I would also appreciate if you took a moment to follow it on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. The Writers of the Future is available in bookstores throughout the U.S., Canada, the U.K., South Africa, and Australia, as well as through all major online retailers. Writers of the Future contains 12 winning authors and 12 winning illustrators selected by some of your favorite names in science fiction and fantasy. You've heard me talking about it for almost 4 years on this podcast, and so you should know by now what I'm talking about. Today, I'm excited to welcome back our Illustrators of the Future coordinating judge, Echo Chernik, as part of our anniversary celebration, specifically 35 years of Illustrators of the Future. So she's been a guest before, so if you've listened to it, you know what an amazing talent she is, and we are so fortunate and lucky that she is our coordinating judge, and things have just gone amazingly well since she's come on board. So without further ado, welcome Echo.
Thank you, John.
So there's all kinds of questions I've got, but first of all, since this is the history of the contest, I just wanted to give a quick overview. The founding judges that we have that are still with us, who will be also with us at the at our upcoming gala, are Bob Eggleton and Val Leahy-Langone. They've been since 35 years with us, and it's amazing just how looking back over it, how much the contest has grown.
I can't believe it's been 35 years so far.
Yeah, it's just It's amazing how much it's grown. Frank Kelly Freeze was our first coordinating judge. I know you know who he is, Echo, but for those of you who don't know, he was the first artist to receive 10 Hugo Awards, the World Science Fantasy Society's Oscars for achievement in the field as best professional artist, pro artist. He created covers for Mad Magazine from 1955 to 62. He created, he was an official NASA mission artist doing space posters. One of his most famous paintings was the cover of Queen's News of the World, which is that robot holding the broken body, human body. He did covers for the Star Trek Annual from DC Comics, and he was a coordinating judge up until he passed in 2005. He also did multiple illustrations for Owen Hubbard, which is how he came to be our original coordinating judge. Following his passing, Ron Lindon, who was also a founding judge until he passed until 2017, he then followed up after Frank, and he was a master of visual communication. He did photography, illustration, graphic designs, and filmmaker. And then when he actually retired in 2017, when he decided to pursue his life as a minister, at that point, we asked Echo, and we are just so fortunate that you've been here. Echo's a traditionally trained artist. She's a graduate of Pratt Institute, summa cum laude, which is the President's Award for Academic Excellence. She has a traditional background in art, focusing on skills such as drawing and painting, as well as perspective and color theory, which was one of the things that makes your class that you teach here at the workshop so important, so vital. So being able to do that allows the artist to translate their concept into whatever media best suits the job. So she's able to work in almost every or maybe every medium that you've got in terms of art. So anyway, with that basic rapid overview of the contest, Echo, what have you observed over the years that you've been both a judge and then when you became the coordinating judge, what have you gleaned from other judges and from past that you learned about up to now? Just a simple overview.
Well, what I've learned from the other judges is that they are all as equally invested in the contest as I am, and I've become. They're just so excited to be there and so excited to see the growth of all of the winners and to really invest in, seeing where their futures and where they're going with their careers. And really to just, to helping the future of the illustrators and to meeting the writers as well. And it's just to really just being involved with the future illustrators and, it's just exciting to just, to feel the energy and to see how excited they are to work with, the next generation. So that's just that's that that's that is like the core that runs through all of the judges. Mm-hmm. Is that that ties all of them together? Is that the pure excitement of just working with each other and sharing all of the years of information and knowledge? Because they'll just commonly sit there and share stories of things they've learned along the way, of you know what to do and what not to do, and yeah. You know, all the mistakes they've made and all the things they've worked well. And they'll learn things from the illustrators that are coming up too, that are much more adept at, you know, technology and the new things. And, you know, and the kids will share new things about like the websites and the new technology stuff with the older judges who are like, oh, that's really cool. Because, you know, they have all the new knowledge that's coming up and they learn a lot from that too. So they learn a lot in return from the you know, the younger generations. So it's just a really great like meeting of minds and stuff. Yeah. So that's like a really just a big common thread. And a lot of the winners, like I was talking to April Solomon, one of the past winners, and she's just she has a weekly meeting with Bob and Larry that they just go on Zoom and talk every week, and they just talk. He just listens to them talk, and they just talk, and they just and it's great that they just keep continuing up that, you know, she's loves listening to their stories because they have like, you know, 80 years of experience between them, and she just loves hearing what they have to say. And just, you know, that's really the big thread that ties everything together. And I think that's what L. Ron Hubbard started, you know, that's what he wanted to start. So
absolutely.
It's like a big tapestry.
Yeah. And it's funny how it grows like that. But then I can't help but think that, you know, the vitalness of having the judges there to keep everyone grounded on basics, because there's this sense of wonder and awe about what the computer can do, what you know in the computer. But, and I'd like you to address this a bit too, just to get the your take as an experienced artist that can cross any, basically every medium of art, the importance of having the basics in as an illustrator, being able to draw. Can you draw the body? Can you draw things? Can you sketch and stuff like that? Can you address that a bit?
Oh yeah, the computer is just a tool, really. It's you know, people are under the impression that it's, you know, this, you know, magic thing, but it doesn't do the thinking really for you as an illustrator. Conveying the idea, reading the story and translating that into the idea of what you want to say, that is still, you know, done in the mind. Even with, you know, AI and everything else, you still have to do that. You know, you still have to do that in your mind. You know, you still have to, you know, to come up with the idea. What am I trying to say, and how am I going to convey that? What tool am I going to use? You know, even now, I mean, I do work digitally, but I still do work traditionally. I'm working on a giant illustrated manuscript right now, and I've chosen to do it partially. I'm doing partially digitally. I'm laying out my entire sketch digitally, but then I'm going to do my painting traditionally, with pen and ink and watercolor. And I'm just choosing to do it that way because that's the look that I want. I could do it digitally. I could do it traditionally. I could do it in oil paints. I can do it 100 different ways, because that's the end result, is just how do I want, you know, the medium to look. The thinking and the problem solving and the visual communication is what illustration comes down to, not the actual tool. You can illustrate in anything. You can illustrate with a pen and, you know, with a broken stick in mud. I mean, you can tell a story with that. I mean, you can, you know, one of the things they had us do when we were in art school is basically we went outside and they had us pick up a stick and tell a story in the dirt with a stick. They're like, all right, we're going to illustrate now, and here, pick up a stick. And we told them we'd illustrate it in the dirt, you know, that just to show us that we can illustrate with any medium. It doesn't matter what you use. It's just because the medium is the medium. So, but it's the storytelling, and it's how you put it together, you know, using your mind and your skills. That's what the important part is, and that's what we try to stress when we're talking to the students.
Yeah,
is the storytelling part of it.
So with that, because it's almost, I mean, I've got a negative growth line on my art, so, but. When I look at someone, I've talked to various artists or people that are aspiring to do that. They've got, you know, sometimes there's a dispersal. Should I do ink? Should I do watercolor? Should I do oil? Should I do acrylic? Because I do a mix here. And they heard these different things and like, oh, I should do this. And maybe they want to be able to talk the talk, but they can't walk the walk on it. And so, but you need to crawl before you can take your first step. And then you can start going faster and faster and faster, and then be able to do the different things. Is there any particular way that is it better or more grounded to be able to securely expand yourself as an artist?
It can be frustrating to not be as good in a medium as you want to be.
Yeah.
Because you go, oh, I wish I could paint like that. I want to paint like that. And, you know, and it could be frustrating because, you know, even I feel that way sometimes. You always look at other artists and be like, gosh, I wish I could do that. I don't know an artist that doesn't look at another artist and be like, wow, I wish I could paint like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, every artist does that. I mean, you know, I've caught other artists that I admire that I sit there and I look at their stuff and I'm like, gosh, I wish I could draw landscapes like that. And they're looking at my stuff. Meanwhile, they're over at my booth going, I wish I could draw figures like that. And I'm like, you know, we all do that because we're like, you know, it's like the grass is greener on the other side sort of thing. The best thing to do is like, you know, what do they say? Like, you know, sow your own quarter acre or figure out what you're good at and what you like to do. And, do what you enjoy and what you, you know, and then start there. Get really good at, you know, what do you enjoy doing? What do you really, you know, what do you like doing? And do that. And people will see the passion and they'll see the passion in what you're doing and they'll recognize that. Don't try to like jump into what's popular or what's a fad. Don't be like, wow, look, drawing like, you know, big eyed puppies is popular. I better learn to do that. Or drawing like super realistic, animated stick figures is popular. Oh, I'll jump into that. You know, just do what you like. You know, if you like drawing, whatever, I don't know. If you like, I don't know, illustrating the realistic rocks or something, you know, paint that, paint because you love it, you know, and then people will see how much you love doing that, and they will, you know, and they'll, you know, they'll be like, wow, you draw, you paint frogs like I've never seen anybody paint frogs. And you're like, I just really, really like frogs. and they'll see that, and they'll be like, you know, I could see how much I've never realized how much I like frogs too. And they'll, you know, and they'll see that. My
when you got your own story about a certain type of art, which was in essence dead or defunct, that you brought back to life.
Yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, Art Nouveau. I've always loved Art Nouveau. Ever since, you know, I don't know, forever. My grandmother used to love to draw like women, like, you know, beautiful women on like her notebook. She wasn't really an artist. She'd say she was never an artist, but she was more of a, she said she was a doodler. She would doodle women all over the edges, like Victorian women. She just doodled them on everything. And I always loved her women. And I always loved to doodle like hair and women and things ever since I was a kid. And so, but I fell in love with Art Nouveau. And so when I started off at the beginning of my career, I explored it and even like my role playing illustrations early on in my career. And I just found I loved that. So I started exploring it. And I decided that that's what I wanted to do. It wasn't popular. It wasn't in style, but I figured this was back in the 90s and I was looking around and I'm figuring, you know, this is about the time that bell bottoms came back in the 90s. And I'm like, all right, if bell bottoms can come back in, Art Nouveau can come back in, because Art Nouveau is way the hell cooler than bell bottoms. And, you know, because I'm like, what the hell is up with the bell bottoms? And I'm like, you know, Art Nouveau is way, way better than that. And so I'm going to bring Art Nouveau back in. So if I keep doing it enough, people are going to see how cool this is. And so I just kept illustrating in my style and people kept hiring me. And there was like a book cover I got hired to do, and I did it in Art Nouveau, and they were like, wow, it's great, can you take some of these swirlies out and just make it look like more realistic? And I'm like, fine. So I did, and you know, and they made me take the Art Nouveau elements out, and then I kept doing it, and ultimately I just kept getting hired for more and more, and then suddenly Art Nouveau was back in, and it was, you know, and I'd like to say it was probably my fault because I kept pushing it, but maybe it works for me. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't totally, because it did come back in the 60s as well. It was because of the resurgence by Bob Massey, who is awesome. I met him at a convention finally, and I was so excited to meet him because I was like, oh my God, I love your work. And he was the most humble guy. He was awesome. And that's another story for another time. But
it also became very popular with the tea. Herbal tea.
The green tea, which is a different style. That's Chinese cloisonné style. And they contacted me for that.
Oh, that's,
and they
that they wasn't wanted, Art Nouveau.
No, that's not Art Nouveau. That's they wanted to know if I could do like a Chinese cloisonné style, and I was like, I don't know, sure, I guess. So you can look it up. It's a hammered metal style, and so I had to look it up. And another thing with illustration is to do a lot of research and figure out, you know, and learn different styles. And so that's part of the fun of it. That's what I like about illustration is, you know, to research and learn. And art history is just phenomenal and just, you know, so interesting. So.
Yeah, now, but one thing I'm curious about is the path that people can take. You know, I've used this a few times as a point of reference. You wouldn't expect someone to go to a store, buy a guitar, you know, strap it on and start, you know, playing these amazing flamenco or these amazing rock licks. You know, you're going to start off and you have to learn, first of all, this is what it's like to pluck each of the strings, and then this is how you tune it and all these different things. And then you start playing your favorite songs, you know, you mm-hmm. learn how to do that. You listen and you mimic that. And it mm-hmm. would seem like with art too, there's going to be a curve where you're going to emulate. Who's I love Van Gogh, or I love, you know, Chernik or whatever. And I'm going to emulate what they do. And just do that to be able to get to the
absolutely. The muscle motion or something. It is okay to emulate people. That's perfectly fine when you're learning. Yeah. I mean, people go to the museums and they sit down and they copy masters as close as they can. When I was learning Art Nouveau, I would open up a book, you know, and copy Mucha's pieces as close as I could. And then when I was starting to really, you know, really learn it, what I would do is I'd study Mucha's pieces, so like really close, and then I would close the book and I would try to do a piece as close to the way Mucha would do it as possible. And ultimately, I couldn't do it as close. I'd look at it and I'd be like, "Wow, this looks nothing like he would do it," but it would be the way I would do it, which didn't ultimately look like he would do it at all. It would look like the way I would do it. And people would look at my pieces and then they go, "Wow, it looks like Art Nouveau, but like not like his pieces, it looks like your pieces." And it did, because I would try to make the decisions he would make, but they wouldn't be his decisions. They would be my decisions. But I was trying to make his decisions, but I couldn't remember his decisions because I wasn't looking at them. I was making my own decisions. So don't look at, like, first copy them so you can, like, you know, see how they would do them. Like, copy them closely and see and like actually look at them and copy the lines, and then do it without copying lines. Like, close it and try to do it from your memory, and like, and then, like, you know, make your own decisions. And that's how I did it. And then, you know, you're going to be making your own decisions at that point and figuring out your own things, and you'll figure out, like, you know, your own style and your own choices, and you'll come up with, that's how you come up with your own style. And and now I find I have all my own choices that I've made, yeah. And I've kind of pulled in things from other styles that way too. So now I kind of have a mix of different styles that have become my choices. And then I can kind of identify things that are specifically me. Now mm-hmm. I can be like, "Oh, these are things that I do throughout my," and that's how you develop a style over the years.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that's something that people need to understand too, is like, you're not going to begin at the beginning with, you know, from the brow of Jove or the brow of Zeus or something like that, springing full force, you know, as an artist. Yeah. You need to work it and work it and work it. And the number of hours that you had as you built up, I mean, you've been at this for at least a decade. So
you've got a decade. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, like a full week or two. Yeah.
You know, but you
you will have some pieces that are complete and utter failures. Trust me, I have some pieces that are just horrible. I mean, yeah, complete failures. I mean, just like, they're just, and like I, you know, and like I tell people that you learn things from your failures too. You're just, trust me. And you learn things from the pieces that you start and you never finish. You know, I mean, you know, sometimes I even go back, I'm like, "Where was that piece that I started that I didn't finish?" And you go back, you dig through and you pull that one out. You're like, "Oh yeah, I started that one," and you pull it out and you're like, "I had something good there." And then like 10 years later, you're like, you pull like this little thing out of that one and put it into a piece that I'm doing like now. Cause there's something in there that you started, but you know, and it doesn't come into play until like 10 years down the line, yeah. Where, you know, it's still valuable. You didn't need it for 10 more years. And you know, so there is something in everything you do, even if it doesn't necessarily work out. So don't feel like you wasted your time, even if you spent all day on something or all week on something that didn't work out, because you're still learning, you know, And even if it's not necessarily, everything you do is learning.
Right.
So it's not, none of it's ever wasted.
That makes sense. Now, yourself as an artist, you've gone from, or what has been your journey in terms of monetizing your work? So did you work for someone else to begin with using your art and then gradually went to commissions? And because now you have your own studio and you have your own shop, your own gallery where you...
I have a gallery, I have a studio. I've always been very determined to be a working illustrator ever since, well, high school, I guess. Always been kind of minded to do that. That's always what I wanted to do. So when I was in high school, I decided that's what I wanted to do. You know, I went to college for it, and I went in. I decided that I wanted to start illustrating right out of school, and which is really, really difficult, especially then. This is before like the internet, really, you know, back in the olden days, back in the 1900s, as my kids say. And and when you had to do like portfolio drops and drop them off, and I was living in New York City, which was, you know, still really friggin' expensive back then. And so, you know, that wasn't really feasible to be like, I'm just going to jump in and be a working illustrator, because, you know, that's just not, you know, really feasible. And so, you know, my husband and I came up with like a plan. And so I was working in the, we were playing role-playing games at the time. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to start off and I'm going to do role-playing game art, because it pays terribly, it pays horribly, it still plays horribly, but I knew I could get jobs doing it and I could make all my mistakes there. And I figured I could screw up in that field and I could miss my deadlines there and I could do all the mistakes. And that way, when I got into like the big paying illustration jobs, I could have hopefully screwed everything up there that I could screw up. And then I wouldn't make any mistakes like later on down the line. And so this was my plan. And so so I started doing that, and right out of school I spent my entire senior year putting my portfolio towards that. And then I got and that worked, and I spent the first 5 years of my career, you know, building that. And I was a working illustrator right out of school, and I worked like really hard and managed to scrape by doing that. And then I got into doing advertising illustration once I was a success at that. And then I spent the first 10 years of my career building that and doing advertising work. Then the internet boom happened, and I had to supplement that work as a web designer, which helped. And so, you know, but I always tell my, and I was teaching as well, and I tell my students to, at that time, always, if you have to get a job at the same time that you're illustrating, try to make sure it's somehow in the field. So whatever jobs I got at the same time, it was always doing something to do with art. So I was teaching illustration, I was teaching graphic design as well as illustrating, and I was also doing web design. So I was like, if you got to get a job, at least, you know, if you got to get it at like a print shop and learn everything you can about like print processes, you know, get it like at a graphic design place so you can like learn about graphic design, like get something in the field so that you can learn about like how they print things, how they do this, so that you can learn about how they lay out illustrations. You can learn more about your own field. Try not to leave the field while you're trying to establish yourself as an illustrator. So that's what I did during the early days of illustration. And then after we had the kids, I knew I was getting regular work there. I still wasn't taking commissions until after we started doing the comic book shows. I didn't have time to take off. I had so many commercial illustrations, like jobs. Mm-hmm. I wasn't taking private commissions or paintings or anything then. I wanted to be able to take time to travel with them. And this is another thing I tell the students at the workshop, is that you have to think outside the box a little bit as an illustrator, because you're not in a normal situation. You're not doing a 9-to-5 job. You're not doing a regular, you know, gig where you don't get vacation days. You don't get like normal, you don't have a normal thing. If you want to do something, you have to figure out how am I going to do this? You know, how am I going to make this work? Because you don't have a normal job. Right. So I'm like, basically, you know, you don't get vacation days. And so I wanted to travel with the kids. And so I'm like, all right, how can I vacation like a normal family? And so we decided to do conventions. And so we bought an RV, and during the summer we would travel with our young children. And that's how I ended up getting painting commissions and going and Travis Hatton. That's how ultimately how I ended up meeting you guys.
Yeah.
And Larry Elmore and some of the other artists and stuff. And now, and that's, And that's how I ended up with my gallery up in Bellingham, and ended up with a mix of not only commercial work, but also private commissions and paintings and such, is by, you know, doing the comic book shows and stuff. So I'm a big proponent of thinking sort of outside the box and, you know, being open to new opportunities when they come along. So, you know, as an illustrator, you have to just sort of see what opportunities come along. So in fishing with many different lures, yeah, and changing your business strategy. And I talk a lot about business strategies and different things with them during the workshop with the winners, because you do have to keep changing your business strategy. And that's, I'm in the middle of doing that right now with everything going on with AI, is again, changing and adjusting the whole business strategy. And you got to keep changing stuff in order to make it adjust to the economy and what's going on with everything. So
yeah, now you brought up this term.
Yes. Yeah.
So as soon as, I mean, we put it in the rules, it's not part of what Illustrators of the Future is, because we're trying to engender those that really are intent about developing their own skills as an artist and not their skills as a AI prompt generator. So what do you see is, you know, the impact of AI? I mean, right now we say, okay, no AI. So immediately you're going to have somebody who wants to game it. They're going to say, okay, I can win the contest using AI, which definitely doesn't help them. And it takes away from someone else who really wants to be able to learn and do traditional art. So what do you see is the long-term impact of AI on art?
That's a challenging and hot subject right now.
For sure.
I'm sure
you know.
You know, it definitely, you know, it's a hotly debated subject right now. It's definitely having a huge impact on everything. They're still figuring that out. It's still balancing, but it's a wise choice to not have it involved right now. AI is not capable of making the nuances and the nuanced decisions that the human brain is capable of. And the small, like for instance, that this manuscript I'm working on right now, it can't make the nuances that I'm making as a visual artist. It can't, you know, even the prompts, it can't control the prompts to the level that a visual artist can. And people argue that it can, but it can't. I mean, you know, I control literally every single line and every single nuance and every single bit of symbolism, and you know, and I control it to such a degree and such a level, it's easy to fall back on it. I mean, it produces pretty things. It produces, you know, things that are like, you know, easy to say, like, oh, that looks good enough. It's sort of like, I always equate it to like fast food. It's good enough. It's, you know, you can eat it and get fat on it, but it doesn't control the quality. You can't control it to the deep.
Yeah.
It's not good enough. It's not good enough. Yeah. It doesn't have that level of, we're better than that. We're so much better than that. You know,
it's like when I was in college, my budget was such that I could afford going to the poster shop and buy posters of the triptych, you know, and so I put that up there, or I'd have something from, you know, some other artist. Wow, this is really cool. I spent my $1.99 or 99 cents, whatever it was back then, back when a penny used to be worth a penny, and would put them up in my college dorm. You know, that's what I could, I liked it, you know, it was really good. And, you know, you could go to the fair and you put that, you know, have the plate that spins around on it, and you put drop the paint on it and it spins around and creates that design.
Yeah.
It was fun. It's like, wow, this is really cool. And you have that, and you can buy a frame for it. And this is my painting that I did. You know, you can have that kind of stuff. But you take a look at now when someone, you know, when you actually look at like a real life oil painting or something that's actually been created, it's just, there's something much more to it, an aesthetic. And if a person can't see that, then they can't see it. You know, I'm not going to.
It's even beyond that. It's the thinking. All right. For instance, to the artists that are entering the contest, even if your skill level isn't up there, it's really easy to compare your skill level to AI, because AI looks all fancy pants, mostly because it's it's stolen like from 30 years of artist experience, and it's making it all like really pretty, really fast. Yeah. Even if your skill level looks not anything compared to the AI, you know, the judges and myself, we can see your thinking through that. So even if you're looking at it going, wow, my technique sucks compared to the shiny, fancy sports car AI thing, we can see your thinking. And your thinking is very clear and concise, and we can see what you're thinking, and we can, you know, and we can see where you can take that with years of experience that AI can't. So don't, like, you know, doubt yourself. Like, do the drawing and do the thinking and do the design, and just trust we know what you're doing and where you're going to go with it eventually. And, you know, don't worry about the technique. You'll get the technique down. You'll learn how to paint better, and you'll learn how to draw better. That you can learn. You can learn that over time. You can learn that with tools. Just, like, you know, show us what you're thinking and what you're communicating. You know, just don't worry about the fact that your painting's not the best yet. You'll get there. That just takes practice.
Yeah, I think that's really important. What you just said there is so important, because usually it's the same thing with writers. The writers and the artists are their own worst enemy, their own worst critic, and for fear of being rejected, they don't move forward, or they don't submit, or they don't want to show their stuff. But there's a difference between the contest and maybe your social media page. Is that the contest, the judges, yourself and others know what they're going through. Because you've been there, done that. You can see, and you see stuff that the average person, not trained, not skilled, not experienced, won't. So I think that's really important that people feel encouraged, because the contest has grown immensely since you've come on board. And one of the things I wanted to make sure that people knew is to not be frightened off from AI, but also on the other hand, don't use AI as, okay, I really want to win this contest. I really want to go out to Hollywood. I really want to get this money. I really want whatever it is they want to do. I really want to meet Echo. So I'm going to use this tool to be able to win the contest. And it's, like you said, you guys can see, you know.
We can see through it. It's built on all shiny, flashy, and it's built on the bones and hard work of our friends. So we can see through all that. I mean, it's built on, like, everything is learned from stuff. It's learned, it's you know, stolen from other artists, and and so we can see through that. You know, what we want to see is what your thinking is, and what you're, you know, and how you're designing and developing, and you know, I don't care if you're you know, I don't care how if your drawing is, you know, if your technique level is not the best. It's, you know, you're that you can learn.
Yeah.
You know, give yourself 5 or 10, or it takes you about 10 years to get really good with a technique. You know, in 10 years it'll be fantastic. It just, you know, but your thinking, you know, your thinking is what's important.
Right.
And AI can't do that. It can't do the thinking.
Right. And that's, I mean, we had an example, I won't use any names, but this year we had someone who made it through, they submitted their art. And so they became a winner of the contest. And then they were submitting the art for the story they were assigned. And then you kept on challenging. Are you using AI? No, no, no. Are you using AI? No, no, no. And then finally, you saw that, look at it, you're using AI. I said, yeah, I did. And then you asked, well, we asked for the money to be refunded. No, I gave it to my church, you know, which obviously they didn't. And, you know, it's just, I can't get it back. So it was, you know, someone tried to game the contest and do this. It's just, you're doing yourself a disservice if you really are interested in becoming an artist. If you're just trying to say, okay, like, I can do this, and have your own, you know, thing of being able to say you beat the system. Even if you make it all the way here, it's going to show up right away when you do your drawing classes. You know, here's the live model stuff, you know. And then we had one winner before, which helped spark this change in the rules. No, that's not my thing, sketching, you know. And didn't show up for that class there. So it was just because that person actually is not an artist. They're an AI person. And so that sparked the changing this whole thing. And, but we're really not interested in somebody doing it. And now that we're, you know, we made it very clear in the rules, we are very sincere about, we want artists. We don't want computer people that just use the prompts in order to generate art. We're not interested in that.
And I have noticed more and more entries of traditional artists lately, which is cool.
That's way cool. One thing I've noticed since you come on board, because now this year we have winners from 8 countries. Last year was 9 countries. And something, you know, obviously there's writers as well, but writers is pretty much restricted to English speaking, but artists are from wherever you can do art. So it doesn't matter what language. And so it's a lot more. So can you talk to me about that on what you look for in illustration, that even though if it's not your style, it's still something that can win.
In terms of, in terms of different countries? Or?
Yeah, well, just type of art, because we see this, you know, the styles from China, from Malaysia, from Vietnam. They're all different. They have different looks to them. Some of them will look, you know, maybe more like what you see on, I guess, Disney or some of the comic book stuff. But otherwise, you'll see stuff that's, it's unique to that country, or what I would seem to be unique to that country, but it's not this normal style that you see in American
stuff. Which I think is really cool.
I love it.
For this particular contest, first of all, how the contest works is that when all the entries come to me first, and so they all come to me, and then I select the top ones, and then I send them off to the judges, and they pick which ones go through and become the winners. And then those are weeded out to become the quarterly ones that become the top 12 ones that are assigned and then become the winners for the year, for each, you know, the ones for each quarter. So I try to pick a wide selection so that they get a big selection of different styles to choose mm-hmm. from. Because I'm not, you know, I don't know. This is supposed to be the top illustrators of, you know, the whole world. And so, you know, I like a variety of styles. I think it's, you know, it's important to have diversity into such a cool and diverse world. So, you know, what I'm looking for is people that can tell a story, people that have a good style, that have a good sense of composition, that have, you know, a good grasp of of characters or of scenes, if they do scenes, of a good, you know, consistent style, preferably, and there are a couple pieces. It is an illustration contest, so, you know, ideally that they're telling a story. It doesn't necessarily have to be my personal taste. Sometimes if I see something and they have a good story and they have a good grasp, I don't have to personally necessarily like the style. I'm like, oh, I don't like that color palette, but that's okay. That's not my taste. If the judges like it, I pass it through to them, because, you know, it doesn't have to be my taste. So it has to go through everybody, because I'm not the gatekeeper of the whole contest here. If as long as it passes the criteria and it is a good style, I like seeing the whole book having some different styles throughout the book. That's what's important, and that's why I like that we get so many entries from all over the world, because it does lend itself to being, you know, so diverse. And we don't know where they're coming from, so that they we do get things from different countries and stuff. Like I've told you in the past, I started off in my career at the beginning doing all black and white work. So I actually, when we get black and white art through, that is strong, I pass black and white work through as well. A lot of contests don't, because, you know, black and white work, it's often underrepresented because it's not really respected. Line art's actually, surprisingly hard to master, because you have to really master that negative space and stuff. And I happen to love black and white work, so I love passing that through personally. So send me all your diverse styles, whether it's black and white or whether it's colored, whether it's, you know, we're from all different corners of the earth. So, in all different mediums.
Yeah. And just the various styles too. So it's obviously not, it has to be this style or that style, because the stuff that you look at, wow, this is definitely Malaysian based upon what I've other seen from other art and from that region, Chinese, Vietnamese, Korean, and then various places in Russia. There's a different, some of the traditional art from those areas, Africa,
really neat.
Is really neat. African. It's just amazing. And so when they can do it and create it and turn it into the speculative aspect of it and tell a story, it's just amazing when I look at, you know, how creative the human mind can actually be. And that's one thing I just love about this contest.
And then Maliva does a really great job pairing the particular style with the writer winners to try to make sure that the illustration winners are matched with a story that they can illustrate for the for their final entry to go for the grand prize. Like if they tend to specialize in doing landscapes, she tries to pair them with a story that specializes in really great landscapes, so that they can, you know, really shine with their final illustration.
Yeah. And just for those who don't know, so the Illustrators of the Future contest, you can find it at illustratorsofthefuture.com or writersofthefuture.com. It's both takes you to the same page. It's free to enter. It's open to anyone who's not been professionally published with their art receiving professional rates. And it gives you how many copies it has to sell in order to qualify as professional. And but it's three pieces of art that are illustration that you submit, and that's what gets judged. And then based upon that, and what the judges see is your art and a number. They have no idea of your name, your nationality, your ethnic, anything. They just see your art and a number. Based upon that, Echo forwards the finalist pieces to the judges, and then they pick who the winner is. And at that point, the contest director takes off the number and assigns the name to it, so then we know who it is and where they're from. And then those three winners every quarter results in 12 winners throughout the year. Those 12 winners, like Echo was just saying, are assigned a winning story from the writing contest. And all 12 winners are flown out to Hollywood for a week-long workshop that's taught by Echo and fellow judges, and then one of those 12 will be chosen as the grand prize winner. And that's based, that grand prize winner is chosen based upon the final art that they create for the story that's been assigned. And quite often, the artists, when they're art directed by you, Echo, this is the first time they've been art directed, and it's a real challenge and a treat for them to be able to do that. And just you can, because you've been there and done that and are so experienced, you can bring out the strengths of an artist, which is just they, because I've done interviews with almost every illustrator winner this year. And that's one of the things they really like is having that direction to push them in where they can, their strengths lie.
I try not to be too hard on them. I try to art direct them gently. I've dealt with good art directors and not so good art directors. So,
But anyway,
unless they tell me to be hard.
Yes. So, but it's with this contest, the thing that I've noticed since you come on board as a judge is the way that the contest is grown with entries coming so many places. I know you, having taught it in schools and having relationships with various schools, you have entries that come from those students, but because this podcast now, I'm getting about 2 million listens per episode, and so it's all over the world. Any particular advice or suggestions? And if you're listening to this and have a friend or someone who's an artist, they should listen to this so they can see how they can take advantage of this too. But once again, just clarify, what are you looking for as the coordinating judge, and why should a person not just hold back or say, no, I can't do it? We have one of our judges, Greg Elliott. Yeah. He was a guest on the podcast a couple years ago, and he said he never entered the Illustrators of the Future contest because he didn't think he was good enough.
Oh,
seriously.
My God.
I know. It's just
serious.
Yeah. And he said, no, I could never enter because I wasn't getting it. But here's the guy that does art direction for, he was a lead art director for Netflix, and he now is back with Disney. He's done all these major, so many of these amazing art, you know, these characters that you see in these animated movies are his creation, and he wouldn't enter the contest.
I'm gonna give him a hard time about that.
Yeah,
I can imagine him saying that. He's so humble.
I know, it's crazy good that he is, but yet.
Oh.
So how many more Craig Ellis are out there who won't do it because either you've got someone on your lines who discourages you?
Nobody's going to just enter. No one's going to see your entry. No one's going to sit there and be like, oh, geez, why did this person enter? I mean, seriously, I see your entry and I promise I won't laugh or be like, why did this person enter? You know, just enter and be like, just enter and then enter again and enter again. And just entering, feel good that you entered. Just enter, enter every quarter. And just because you didn't win one quarter, it doesn't mean you weren't good enough. Sometimes I get a bunch of entries that are very similar. Like I might get a bunch of entries that have landscapes. And I'm like, wow, I got a whole bunch of landscape entries this quarter. And I don't want to send the judges too many landscape entries because it's going to be just too many this quarter. And so I have to pick like two. And so I hope these other two people enter next quarter, please enter next quarter. And so, I'm secretly hoping that they'll enter the next quarter. So you have to enter every quarter so that just in case you didn't get picked this quarter, you enter again just so that you have a chance next quarter, just because, you might have just missed out just because there were too many one quarter and not,
Yeah.
And it was just that the timing was wrong. So just keep entering every quarter, even if you didn't get in. It's just, sometimes just people just enter. I get a lot one quarter and nobody the next quarter just because there was finals or something. And, and so just keep entering every single quarter, even if you send the same things in. You can send the same stuff in.
Unless you become a finalist or there's at a point when you can't resubmit stuff because it's now.
Yeah. If you're a finalist, I think you can't resubmit it.
But one thing too, is that an artist becomes better by doing their art. So it's also to your advantage to keep on creating new art and submitting it. And that's with the writer's side, it's encouraging, mm-hmm. write a new story, because the only way to become good as a writer is by writing. And it would seem the way that you're going to become better as an illustrator is to illustrate.
Yeah. But even if you don't have new stuff, just, don't freak out and be like, oh my God, I didn't get anything new done. Just submit it again. And then just keep working on new stuff, because sometimes, you make a bunch of stuff in 1 month and then you don't do anything for a couple months and then you do a bunch of new stuff and, so it's just keep making new stuff and submit whatever you have new.
Good,
so.
Yeah. And just realize that Echo doesn't know who you are. All she sees is a number and your art. So it's not anything I look at. I'm going to be so embarrassed if I see her at a convention. She knows, oh my gosh, you're Daisy May. It's she would never know that because all you're going to know is number 256, and which isn't a name. So she would never know if she met you at a convention that she had rejected some of your art. It's just not going to happen.
Oh no.
So on, I guess the whole thing of entering the contest, because we've got a scene right now where the contest entries are increasing by leaps and bounds each quarter with the Illustrator contest. And we've gone past the point now because we have there's a lot more interest in writing contests, but the Illustrator is growing faster right now than the writer contest. And it's to the point now, and because of the reputation of the contest, because it's blind judged, that winners no longer say I was rejected with an honorable mention. They say I won an honorable mention in Writers of the Future. And they put that now in their pitch letter saying I won an honorable mention. And that takes your work out of the slush pile. And we're rapidly moving that way as well with the Illustrator contest as it grows and as people recognize the value of being able to say, yes, I was an honorable mention in Illustrators of the Future, that it actually lets art directors know, okay, this person's got something going for them. Let me take a look and see what they've got. Can you comment on that, just on the growth and what these different levels might signify?
About getting an honorable mention?
Silver honorable mention, finalists. Yeah, what that signifies when you receive these?
Well, if you get a semifinalist, that means you were almost a finalist. A finalist means that you were sent over to the judges so that the judges could choose whether or not you were a winner. A semifinalist means that you were the runner-up to that, so that you almost made it over. You were like next in line, just in case, you know, someone didn't quite, you know, make the cut. And if they, you know, you were next in line, for instance, if somebody was found to have used AI or something, that you would, you'd be next in line to, if they got disqualified or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I almost made it. So a lot of times semifinalists, you get bumped up if someone was disqualified or something. So that means you were like super close. So that's like a super good thing. So, you know, definitely be excited if you're a semifinalist, and, you know, enter again, because, you know, you were like so close. And and then on an honorable mention means that, you know, that it's looking, you know, fantastic. I saw something in there that just looks just really good. I like your, you know, your figures or your storytelling, or I really see something in there that, you know, that it just looks exemplary. A lot of times if I have time, I'll leave notes that about something that I really like, that, you know, that you should keep working on. And that means just give you an honorable mention, that means I just want you to just keep working on it and encouraging you to just keep submitting. Just because, there's something there that just looks, you know, really, really heading in a good direction. So it's just my way of encouraging you to just keep going, and, you know, and letting you know to, I don't know where a silver honorable mention is. I think I only have
the only honorable mention right now. It comes up as it's going to continue to grow, just to be able to distinguish. But that's just something that people need to recognize, is that the contest is about recognizing the artist. And Elwin Hubbard was very vocal on the subject of the importance of the arts. He observed that it's the artist that actually sets the pace and the style for the future of society. You know, it's the artist that designs what people are going to wear. It's the artist that comes up, that conceives the cool things, you know, that you've, like I said, Frank Kelly Fries, when he was designing the patches for NASA, and they come up with these different designs for spacesuits and different things that actually use. It's the artist that conceives these different things, building, you know, the graphic design. You know, you've got all these different things. It's the artist that conceives them and makes it good. And you take a look at some cities in America are really blasé, and we need a few Illustrators of Future winners around there to help on their building designs. Mm-hmm. They're so like
My daughter's 19, and she's just, you know, she's being an artist with, you know, with me. She's going to shows with me now, and she's explaining the gallery with me. And she keeps asking me, she's like, how come every time I come up with an idea and I just start like sketching it out and, you know, thinking about it, like within a few months, all of a sudden it's like out there in public, and I see that someone else has come up with the same idea. And she's like, you and Dad do the same thing. You come up with an idea, and like within 2 years, it's like out in the public. I'm like, that's because we're artists, hon. And, you know, and that's how that works, because we're kind of like tapped into the creative feed, and we kind of make what comes with the next, you know, what becomes the popular culture. I mean, that's the kind of our job, is to define what the world is and becomes popular. That's your job. Yeah. So if you feel that something should be popular, or should be, you know, you have a feeling that something, you know, really needs to exist or look a certain way, I'm like, design it, make it, do it, because, you know, you're kind of leading the way things should look. So just make it, you know. That's your job as an artist, is to create the way the world looks.
Yeah. And how it can look or should look in certain areas.
That's your actual purpose in life.
Yeah. And one thing too that really stands clear, which is why illustration is so important, is like one of the things in one of the essays that you cover at the workshop from Mr. Hubbard, is art is the quality of communication. And there's that aspect. And over the years, when I've talked to past winners, they've all said, you know, what do you remember most? And said, well, that one datum, you know, art is a quality of communication, that you got to be able to communicate with your art. And that's the senior datum there, is like, what are you trying to communicate? Mm-hmm. So anyway, we've got our last like 3 minutes or so here. So with this in mind, like, what would you say as a, I mean, we've gone through so many different things here, but as a point of communication, and to the artists, what type of inspiration or tip would you give, as for someone who's maybe got is surrounded by self-doubt on how to be able to take the next step, or if you're surrounded by people that aren't encouraging, because that, unfortunately, that happens too. How do you take your next step as an artist?
Well, especially right now, it's a daunting time right now to be an artist. That's for sure. Just keep creating art, and you know, try not to listen to other people. Just, you know, keep drawing and try to surround yourself by people that are encouraging and not discouraging. Just, you know, cut the discouraging people off of your map. There was somebody once that told me that they keep a neighborhood in their head, and they keep all of the encouraging people in their neighborhood. And if there's just discouraging people, they don't let them live in their neighborhood. They only keep the encouraging people in their neighborhood. And they so surround yourself only with the encouraging people that help you make your art, and the people that lift you up. And you know, just, you know, keep making your art, and don't try not to compare yourself with AI or, you know, any of the other people. Just, you know, find what you're good at, what makes you happy. That's the most important thing. If you like working in a certain medium or like looking at certain things, just do that. And, mm-hmm. you know, and, you'll get better over time. The more you do something, you know, the better you'll get, you know, so, you know, just little steps at a time, and, you know, go for those goals, even if they don't, you know, just go little at a time, and you'll get there eventually. And, you know, just go for little happies, and you'll get to the big happy eventually. So, and enter the contest. Yeah. That's a big thing. And, you know, and talk to as many people as you can, especially people that have been in the industry for a really long time. And they'll tell you all kinds of stories, and they'll encourage you. Really being around other artists, I find, every time I leave the contest and I've talked to other artists, I feel, you know, that much more, invigorated and encouraged and empowered to go out and do things. Spending a lot of time by yourself, you just, you know, you kind of like lose your battery power after a while. So, yeah. You know, definitely spend more time around other artists, and you get, you know, you find yourself all charged up after you're done. So
good. Okay. So one final question is, for somebody who's not familiar, because I've been saying, extolling the amazingness of Echo Trinity. So how can people find you to be able to see different types of art that you've done?
I have an Instagram that I'm trying to, you know, do more on. It's Echo Chernik, ECHOCHERNIK. I also have a website. It's Echo Chernik, same spelling. And that's probably the best way to find me. I have a Facebook too, also spelled the same. And, but I'm trying to keep up on the Instagram, really trying.
Okay. That's great. Well, thank you very much, Echo.
Yay.
And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We've also been syndicated on the United Public Radio Network, where you can find these podcasts as well. Writers of the Future series can be purchased wherever books are sold in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, and South Africa, and available everywhere via Amazon.com. We're especially appreciative of our sponsor, Carnation, for supporting this podcast. Carnation is actually celebrating 1.25 centuries of making milk products. It's amazing just how, you know, they've continued going this long and continuing to expand. And I just wish you a happy birthday. I'm very, very appreciative of you sponsoring this podcast. And if you've not tried their various milk products on your coffee or your tea or whatever, I highly encourage you to do so. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by Owen Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Echo.
Thank you.
The L. Ron Hubbard Writers and Illustrators of the Future contests have left a tremendous mark on the science fiction and fantasy field.
Both contests have been discovering and providing platform for both writers and illustrators for 4 decades.
It's impossible to measure the impact these contests have had on the field. In the early days of the contest, in the mid-80s, the workshop was held at a remote hotel at the end of Sag Harbor. It was Algis Budrys and Orson Scott Card and myself teaching. And then from that remote, wind-blown place where we had the workshop, the actual event happened in New York City in Manhattan. And it was the only time in my life I've ever met Isaac Asimov. There was the physicist Sheldon Glashow, Mark Hamill, the array of important people attending and celebrating it was simply dazzling.
I remember the first time that I came to the workshop and illustrators began piling out of the elevator. We started reviewing the portfolios. It was Kelly Fries, Paul Lear, and Ron and I. And we just had a wonderful time. We enjoyed looking at the artwork. And then we got Bob Eggleston, Vin DeFay, Larry Elmore, and more illustrators became popular and famous as the time grew by, from last century to this century.
When somebody wins the contest, it's a really big deal. They get flown out to Hollywood for a week-long workshop. They spend time networking with each other and hanging out and learning from some of the biggest names in the writing and the illustrating field.
Through the years, the workshop has been held at a number of different places, including Seattle, including Houston NASA Center in Texas, including Cape Canaveral in Florida, where we all got to see a space shuttle launch. In addition to studying very helpful essays that L. Ron Hubbard wrote, the winners are sent out on the street to